This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. There are companies that most of us interact with on a regular basis. YouTube, LinkedIn, Yelp. Many of those companies in our lives, and all the ones I just named, can trace their origins to someone who was previously involved in PayPal. The attention in Silicon Valley goes to companies building electric cars or launching rockets to Mars or connecting societies around the world. Less exciting, it might seem, is the world of online payments, sending money over the internet. But the subject comes alive in Jimmy Soni's new book called The Founders, the story of PayPal and the entrepreneurs who shaped Silicon Valley. In its review, the New York Times called it an intensely magnetic chronicle in which ambitions and emotions run as red hot as they did in the Facebook movie written by Aaron Sorkin, The Social Network. As we'll hear, the title, The Founders, has a double meaning. It's about the founders of PayPal, but it's also about how so many people who were there at the beginning would go on to found scores of other world-changing companies. One other reason we at the 21st were drawn to this story is that many of the people who created PayPal came through Central Illinois, studying computer science at the U of I Urbana-Champaign. I spoke with Soni back in April, which is when we first broadcast this interview. Because of that, we're not taking calls for this segment, but do let us know what you thought and suggest future guests by emailing talk@21stshow.org. Okay, here now is my conversation with Jimmy Soni on his book, The Founders. Jimmy Soni, welcome to the 21st Show. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having me, Brian. I really appreciate it.
So you begin the story of PayPal with co-founder Max Levchin, and his family immigrated to Illinois from Ukraine when he was in high school. He was very much into computers and told his guidance counselor he wanted to go to MTI. Can you pick up the story from there?
Right. So you have a young Ukrainian immigrant who is very sharp with math and science, but his English skills leave still a little bit to be desired. And there's a translation error, a slight translation error. And he had heard about MIT in Ukraine and kind of became, he had a math and science oriented family. He becomes obsessed with the idea of going there and really wants to go there. He's competitive and he's smart and he's getting good grades in those subjects. And he tells his guidance counselor, I'm going to go to MTI. I'm going to go to MTI. And it's a quirk of translation. And for some reason, like that just didn't, she wasn't able to rearrange the letters or something. And she said, well, I don't know what that is, but you should go to, you know, University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana is right here. And it'll be a great place for you. And they have a strong program in computer science and in math and in engineering. And, you know, he actually has to apply as an international student because he misses the student, the deadline for domestic students.
I love that detail in the story of how, you know, even here, he's like hacking aspects of his life because there's a welcoming ceremony at the airport or something like that.
Yeah, it's actually one of my favorite stories in the book. And I can share a couple pieces of it that did not that didn't make it into the book. So Max Levchin has been in America at the point at which he applies to university. He's been in America for, I think, a year and a half to 2 years. But he applies as an international student because he's like, well, I'm international-ish and I missed the deadline. Let's see if it works out. They admit him. But the thing about being admitted as an international student is that there's an assumption that you're coming to America for the very first time when you arrive. And so the welcoming committee for international students sends him this note, a formal sounding note, as he put it to me, and it's in the book, it didn't sound optional, that he has to meet them at the airport at an appointed time. Now, he's already on campus because he lives just north of here and outside of Chicago. But he's on campus and he basically repacks his suitcases, goes to the airport and has to kind of like play act the international arrival, right? And he's like wide-eyed and like, oh my God, it's so incredible to be in America. And so he has to do this whole theatrical thing because he feels like if he doesn't and they find him out, well, you know, his college acceptance is done for. Later, he submits paperwork so that he no longer has to be a faux international student. And so it all obviously worked out. But I do think of this as a funny moment where he's hacking even the application process for his state university.
I love that. I love it. All right. So talk a little bit about the environment at UIUC. Why did his guidance counselor think it was a good place to go other than MTI or MIT?
Right. So he is passionate, as are many in his generation, about an emerging digital world. This is the years that we're talking about are kind of the early and mid 90s. The internet is just coming into its own. It was this hobby for, well, nerds, and it's becoming mainstream. And what is happening at the University of Illinois is you have this incredibly dynamic environment that's been built, not like just in that period, but been built for decades, where UIUC is the epicenter of computing. They have huge federal grants. Those grants allow for the purchasing of a lot of interesting machines. UIUC is where some of the world's first digital social networks are created. It has some of the world's most powerful and first computers. I mean, you could point to almost any domain of computing and probably find like a first, second, or third place award for whatever the innovation is, and find that its home was UIUC. Into that milieu steps Max Levchin. He's already passionate about computers. You know, he's come to the Midwest. He's a new American arrival, but he loves computing. He comes down, and one of the first things that happens to him is he goes to Quad Day, and all these student organizations are recruiting for the person they're looking for. He sees, as he puts it to me, a group of nerds standing around a cardboard box. And the reason there's a cardboard box is because the cardboard box is blocking out glare from the sun so that these nerds can look at a computer screen. And he affectionately, obviously, with the two decades room, looked at me and said, I found my people.
Yeah, you have this line in the book. These people were not going to let a sunny day get in the way of their coding.
Exactly. So he joins ACM, and the Association for it's a group that is devoted to all things computing. And what it allows him to do is to blend what would become his professional life with what is then his extracurricular life.
And it's interesting at this time because you have the prospect of big time success, financial success, in the example of Mark Andreessen.
That's right. So just as young Max Levchin and several of the other PayPal co-founders and earliest employees are arriving at UIUC, Mark Andreessen is leaving. And the reason he's leaving is he has been there. He's helped to develop a browser, a web browser, one of the world's first, called Mosaic. It becomes a success. And he sees commercial possibilities in the future of web browsing. So he goes and takes his talents west and builds a company called Netscape. Netscape goes public. And all of a sudden, this UIUC student, not too dissimilar from Max Levchin and Luke Nosek and all the other PayPal folks, is on the cover of Time magazine. And he's created something that's turned the internet into something that all of us who don't write computer code can now access. It's taken the internet from this, you sort of had to have specialized knowledge to, I can click, I can point, I can surf. It's really slow and it's happening over my phone line. And if my parents pick up the phone, they'll interrupt me, but it's more accessible than it once was. That the fact that Mark Andreessen was at the University of Illinois just before Max Levchin and some of his friends get there is hugely inspiring. And that's, by the way, that's not my opinion. That is what many of them played back to me. One person, Jawed Karim, who went on to co-found YouTube, said the following words: Mark Andreessen is the reason I was at UIUC. I so wanted to follow in his footsteps. That's why I was there.
So talk a little bit more about this blending of personal life or maybe work life, hobby, and academic life, how these things are coming together. A lot of these students are setting up either side hustles where they're writing code for someone else or even forming their own companies.
Yeah, I couldn't help but learn these stories and think to myself, like, there was almost no part of their life that didn't touch computing. So you could take Max Levchin as a prototypical example. When he's in class, he's in computer science and engineering classes. When he's speaking to the faculty in those classes, they're inviting him to hangouts and get-togethers where it's a lot of people talking about computers and the emerging internet. I interviewed one of his former professors who was a kind of a mentor figure. And the thing that Max Levchin admired about him that he wrote about in a long-lost essay that I rediscovered is basically this guy worked all the time, and he would come in with really interesting practical computer challenges that we were made to solve. So that's coursework. You have another thing that he's doing. He's developing companies. So Max creates four companies before PayPal, all at the University of Illinois and all with people there who are doing basically the same thing. It wasn't weird to be a sophomore undergraduate and also be a co-founder of two startups, right? And then the last piece is the Association for Computing Machinery, ACM, where they are doing things like virtual reality in 1996 and 1997. They're building machines. They're inviting Steve Wozniak to come and kind of, you know, talk about the wonders of computing. So you have an era in which and a place in which Max Levchin and his friends are basically exposed to computing round the clock. They soak it up. Some of them drop out to go, you know, pursue these things on the West Coast. But Max stays to finish his degree. I think of UIUC, and it really is as a fertile and unheralded source of much of the talent that made PayPal. But I would also argue their impact is much broader. I mean, that there's so many co-founders and founders of internet companies from that era who, you know, they have Midwestern roots.
And when you're doing this computing work at the time, you're really involved in all aspects in a way that maybe today, right, people, there's so much on the cloud. But they had to like have their own servers delivered on semi-trucks and stuff like that. I mean,
yeah, it was interesting because this is pre-cloud. It's almost funny to write about the era, right? Like, because you have this set of circumstances in which people, you know, there's a story that Max has an unexpected success with his final company that he builds at the University of Illinois. In order to make that company's success possible, meaning in order to deal with the flood of users who are coming and using these products, he has to order a server. The server shows up on a big rig truck. They don't expect it to show up on a big rig truck. It has to be hauled up to this office that he's rented, right? This kind of like with its various IKEA discards. The server's there. The problem with the server is once you've built a server and once a company's successful, you're not moving that server. And so there's this problem of we've got this enormous server, this sort of successful company. What are we going to do? Luckily for Max, a fellow UIUC student turned dropout, Scott Bannister, organizes the sale of that final company for a very small amount of money, but it allows them to ship the server out west, right, and to move it. And it allows him a clean break to move to Palo Alto and begin the next chapter of his life. But at the time, you know, I think I say these things out loud and they sound, even saying it out loud, it's like he was a student who was running into credit card debt in order to lease offices and buy gigantic servers so that he could build a company that he would then sell. I don't know how many college students even today are doing something like this.
Let me take a moment to reintroduce my guest. If you're just joining us, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Jimmy Soni, who's the author of The Founders, The Story of PayPal and the Entrepreneurs Who Shaped Silicon Valley. Max Levchin and some of his University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign classmates, they're heading west. They go to Palo Alto, Silicon Valley. In this part of the story, the role of chance here is really kind of remarkable to me, right? You talk about Levchin meeting Peter Thiel basically because he didn't have air conditioning.
Mm-hmm. That's right. You know, when Max Levchin arrives in Palo Alto in 1998, he's arriving at, call it like the, you know, sort of these three quarters or almost all the way through the dot-com boom. And so he knows some people in the area. He knows Scott Bannister, who dropped out of the University of Illinois to go west to make his fortune. He knows Luke Nosek, who completed his degree and went west as quickly as possible. And he knows a handful of other people. And while he's there, he runs into this problem of he has no money and he's sleeping in a place without air conditioning. And he wants to take a break from the Palo Alto heat. The way he does that is he mills about Stanford's campus. He'll see interesting lectures, right? Like kind of lectures that are just public lectures. And he will sort of seat himself at the very back of the lecture hall and catch just a little bit of cold air for an hour and listen to whatever the person has to say. He thought when he saw the advertisement for the Peter Thiel lecture that it would be something similar. He had heard Peter's name once before. Peter had invested in a company that Luke Nosek had started, so he had some sense of who this person was. So he goes to this lecture thinking, oh, you know, maybe 200, 300 people. I'll sit in the back. I'll listen if I want to, but I'm really just there for the air. He shows up and it's a handful of people and they're seated sort of seminar style. So you're not going to be able to slack off in a class with only a half a dozen people. He sits and he immediately is taken in by Peter's way of explaining financial markets. That is what leads Max to introduce himself to Peter Thiel. And that's maybe one of the places one could argue PayPal begins is in this Stanford class that Max Levchin attends because he would like some air conditioning.
Well, let's get to then some of the ideas that shaped the early days of PayPal. First, maybe you can remind us, what was payment like? What was e-commerce like in the mid to late 1990s.
Yeah, you know, we take for granted things like, you know, Venmo and Zelle and Cash App and PayPal, because they're basically, they have become as organic to us as whipping out $5, right? I mean, it's sort of reached almost that level of familiarity. But where I was writing about kind of the years, let's say 1996 to 2003, most people are still pretty skeptical about entering credit card information and online. You're not really doing too many mobile transactions because your cell phones are gigantic and they don't really, you know, they're not suited for that.
I didn't have my first cell phone until 2000 anyway.
There you go.
Right.
and so you're in an era in which digital payments, you know, it's still, this sounds almost futuristic, right? It's sort of it sounds natural to us, digital payments. Back then it sounded like you were kind of like, you know, you're projecting into some Jetsons-like future. But there were some startups and some, you know, DigiCash starts in 1989. Accept.com is built in 1998. There are a few, and it's increasingly the case that even banks are recognizing, look, we're going to have to deal with this internet thing, and it's going to change the way people do commerce. But the startups, as is almost always the case, the startups are the ones moving more quickly. And they, Max Levchin spies what he thinks is an opportunity in mobile payments. So his view is, if you have a Palm Pilot and I have a Palm Pilot, we ought to be able to exchange money using those two devices. And the great innovation that he comes up with in early 1999 is the forerunner to PayPal, and that is infrared beaming across these two devices. So in 1999 is when Palm Pilot, you might remember, introduces these little tiny infrared ports, sort of like what you see on a remote control. And Max wants to do encrypted transactions that are actually real transactions between these devices.
I had a Palm Pilot in the year 2000, and I didn't have anyone to beam with. That's one feature I never got to use, the infrared aspect of that thing.
Maybe one of my favorite things about doing this whole project was I actually bought and read Palm Pilot for Dummies, because I kind of went nuts on these like little rabbit hole parts of the research. And when I got to the part in Palm Pilot for Dummies about the infrared port, it was probably, like, I honestly still laugh about it. Like, I laughed about it out loud to myself when I was reading it. And the reason is because it says, if the infrared ports are too far away, users won't be able to have a connection. If they're too close together, they won't be able to have a connection. And there's not really apps that come pre-installed that actually use the beaming interface. So good luck to you, right? Like, the best I could find online was somebody was using them to play Battleship, and that was about it.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, more with Jimmy Soni, the author of The Founders, The Story of PayPal and the Entrepreneurs Who Shaped Silicon Valley. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're listening back to my conversation from April of this year with author Jimmy Soni. His book is The Founders, The Story of PayPal and the Entrepreneurs Who Shaped Silicon Valley. Before the break, we were talking about how many of those entrepreneurs, before they landed in the valley, came through the prairie of central Illinois. We were talking before the break about payments. What was so difficult about digital payments, other than just even conceiving of it as something, like, I was just thinking back. I think the first time I actually bought something on the internet might have been the summer of 1999, my first Amazon purchase at the time. It was a CD of This American Life. But what is so challenging for people about getting banks to talk to each other? It seems so easy now with, you mentioned Venmo as an app, for example.
You know, I think maybe the better question or a cousin question that answers yours is, what wasn't hard about it, right? So in a way, what you have is, so people are, you know, let's sort of go back in the time machine. People are taking their first steps even into being online, right? Let alone transacting or doing anything serious online. So this is like the first era in which you're actually getting on the internet. So that's like hurdle one, right? Hurdle two is, e-commerce is still like an emerging domain. There's not, you know, Amazon exists. It's not as large as it is today. It's not really as ubiquitous as it is today. And people's default is still, if you need to buy something, you go to a store and buy it, right? Then you've got this sort of next hurdle, which is, most people have a relationship with a financial institution, meaning a bank of some kind that's keeping their money or running their credit cards or whatever. Those entities are slow to digitize, meaning they're not like aggressively moving fast. One of the things I found is this Wells Fargo historian who wrote this funny post about Wells Fargo's first website, where they use the images of the Wells Fargo stagecoaches, but they forgot that those images are pretty hard to download. And so one of the first complaints they got is like, the images are taking like 5 minutes to, you know, they're like super slow to download. It's so funny. And users complained, like, I can't do anything with this website. So the whole apparatus needs to be put in context. This is not the internet of today, fast connections, where digital payments are second nature. The two other pieces that really affect PayPal, one is, you know, it's also the era in which you're starting to see the first digital fraud emerge. So just as you get digital payments, you also get digital, you know, you get digital bad actors. And so you have these people who are using the emerging crop of payment technologies to do bad things. And then you also have this issue of, it's really hard to make money doing small dollar payments. And what PayPal manages to do is actually succeed where many, many, many others have failed, which is enabling small dollar transactions on a website called ebay.com. And by the point at which PayPal emerges, eBay is a publicly traded company, but it's still young and it does not have a standardized digital payment system. And that's where PayPal makes its bones.
People are still mailing each other checks at this point. They make the transaction on the internet and complete it through the mail.
Oh, they even complete some PayPal transactions by mail. I'll give you a great example, which is this. There's a technology that PayPal develops that probably every single listener is familiar with. If you need to connect your bank account to something today, what often happens is that bank will send you two tiny little deposits, 52 cents and 47 cents, right? So your code, your ATM code, temporary ATM code is 5247, 5247. PayPal invented that technology. It was called random deposit. And it was created because PayPal had the same problem. Brian, if you tell me that you own the bank account, how do I know? If it's just a checking account number and a routing number, you could get those off of any voided check. By inserting those two little deposits into your account, I know that it's you because you have access to that account. Or at least I have a level of trust that you are who you say you are. PayPal's users, ironically, were honest enough that a few of them, worried that they were getting kind of ill-gotten gains from the company, mailed back change to the company's offices that had to be deposited at Silicon Valley Bank. And I interviewed the young man who was in, I think, business development, whose responsibility it was to take all of this loose change and drive it over to Silicon Valley Bank and deposit it. And his story is funny because he later becomes a professional magician. He gets pretty tired of driving these coins to the bank. So he's been doing magic on the side. He's now like arguably Silicon Valley's leading professional magician.
Amazing. Well, on the subject of fraud, and that is something where Lev Chin, who you know, attended the University of Illinois, he plays a fairly big role fighting fraud in the story. I wondered how much I can blame him and David, is it Gosbeck?
Gauzebeck.
At PayPal for the fact that I'm, you know, constantly clicking on traffic lights and fire hydrants and palm trees. I think that's going to be something that's familiar to just about everyone who's listening to us as a seminal user experience of the web even today.
Yep. So I think, you know, I don't know, blame might be a strong word. It depends, I guess, in the eye of the beholder. You could credit them, but let's say it's somewhere between there. You're absolutely right. The technology that everyone listening has to suffer through, where you're required to find fire hydrants next to images that are not fire hydrants, is called the CAPTCHA. And the first commercial application of the CAPTCHA on the internet is invented at PayPal. And it's invented by two UIUC alumni, David Gauzebeck and Max Levchin. In fact, the first name was the Gauzebeck-Levchin test. That's what it was called. To be historically accurate, and because people have taken flack for this, Carnegie Mellon invents a version of the CAPTCHA. And the purpose of the CAPTCHA is really simple. It's to tell humans apart from robots. So the problem that PayPal was facing, the reason they even had to reinvent or invent this thing, is because robots were creating automated accounts to siphon away bonus payments. So they were getting hit with huge amounts of like random person creates a bot, uses, you know, creates 100 accounts and they're getting 10 bucks an account, they get $1,000. PayPal needed a way to basically throw some sand in the gears of the robots. They invent this test as a way of doing that. And we live 20 years later with having to prove that we are humans and not robots.
Let's talk a little bit about what made these founders, and not just the big names that people, you know, that are still household names today, Elon Musk, Peter Thiel, Max Levchin to some extent, Reed Hastings. But this is really a constellation of so many more people. What was it about them that was so unique? They're using these clunky web browsers on giant glass tube monitors, rudimentary Palm Pilots, and yet they're seeing the future possibilities of supercomputers in our pockets used for communication and banking and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think, you know, and I've really wrestled with this question a lot. So I spent, you know, 5.5 years talking to all of these people. And the reason I called the book The Founders is partly because the people who are a part of this group go on to found so many other companies: LinkedIn, SpaceX, Tesla, YouTube, Yelp. They all emerge from this group of people. And all of these people happened to work at PayPal between 1998 and 2002. My thesis was always, I don't think that's a coincidence. Like, I don't think it's accidental that all of you ended up there and maybe learned something. So I wanted to find out what was in the water. I think it, you know, hopefully what the book does is sort of show you what was in the water. To skim at the surface a bit, one of the big things is, I would say there was this kind of problem-solving orientation. And by that, what I mean is, like, there was a real desire on the team, even in the off hours, to solve puzzles, to solve problems, to come up with the right answer, and to do it in an almost competitive way. Apply that to what they're doing in the space, in the payment space. That's a big part of what they had to do. You had to invent some solution to the challenge of distinguishing humans from robots. You had to invent or solve some way to determine that Brian is not, you know, a phony when he says, this is my bank account. So you have this problem solving or puzzle solving instinct that is a big part of the company. The second thing I would say is they recruited very, very technically competent and very just generally intelligent people. There was a very high bar to get into this place. You know, they had all kinds of interesting ways they recruited. A lot of the recruiting came through personal networks. So there was a very high bar for intelligence, raw horsepower, and the desire to work really, really hard. I think you'd be remiss if you didn't point out that there was a lot of luck and a lot of timing. As you pointed out, you know, even Peter Thiel and Max Levchin meeting and having this opportunity is because of this air conditioning thing that Max is dealing with. But they also close a very big round of fundraising in March of 2000. A week after they close their fundraising, the stock market starts a slide that wipes out, huge. It wipes out, I think, like 78% at one point off the NASDAQ, right? So the dot-com bust starts. PayPal is partially saved because it closes a very big round of financing just before the bust starts. And so they're at the tail end of the boom. They're able to ride out through the bust. And then at the end of the bust, the lesson they've learned is that developing internet companies is hard but doable. And if you walk out from an experience like PayPal and you don't have like the scars of failure, right? And you don't have the comforts of an easy success, what you see before you is, hey, you know, there was a dot-com bust, but it's time for the renaissance now. And that is why one of the reasons why I think so many Web 2.0 companies come out of this group. I would also say the final piece of this is, you know, they moved so quickly. Like, one of the things that I discovered about this team is just how rapidly they pushed the product and continued to improve it, continued to release refinements. I had this experience. I interviewed a customer service rep who worked in Omaha, so not at headquarters in Palo Alto. And one of the things that she said to me is, she said, you know what always blew us away in Omaha is that if customers raised a concern, we would call Palo Alto and they seemingly worked through the night and would send us a note in the morning saying that they had fixed whatever problem arose. There wasn't a schedule for when you made updates. You just made updates all the time. That led to problems, but it also led to a product that was evolving at the rate that the internet was evolving at the time.
And you write about, and I can't remember the person's name now, but it's this idea of, we don't plan and then act. We just invent something.
Yeah. In fact, that quote, which is one of my favorite ones in the book, and it comes from Eric Klein, another UIUC graduate. He is a friend of Max's. He joins the company. And he said that I asked him, what was one of the things that you take away from this whole experience, right? And he said, even today in standups, meaning these sort of groups of computer engineers coming together to solve a problem. He says, even in standups today, I will often think, how can we invent our way out of this? It's about invention, not research and implementation. Now, I don't think that works every time, but for him, it actually led to this place of, well, we can create a new fix for a problem as opposed to Googling for the answer, right? And so it gives them this healthy orientation toward, you might almost call it sort of an engineer's chutzpah, where it says, we're going to solve this. Even there might be other solutions, right? Like, the CAPTCHA was invented a year before it was invented at PayPal, but we're going to solve it all on our own. And it might take us more time and it might take more resources, but we're going to do it.
Yeah, it's so far from my own mindset. I mean, geez, talk about just spent so you spent 5 years on a book. Talk a little bit about your process of why this book. You remarked in the book itself and in some interviews I've heard since how surprised you were that this story hasn't been told before in this way. And a lot of the people you talked to said, oh, no one's ever asked me about PayPal before.
Yeah, it's still a curiosity in my mind. I think I figured someone would have come, like, it felt like a very Walter Isaacson book, and Walter's a mentor and a friend. I often wondered, like, Walter, this was totally your thing to do. The best answer that I can come up with for why it wasn't done is that it's just simply really hard to do. So in Palo Alto, you have 200 plus employees, pre-IPO PayPal employees. In Omaha, you have another 500, 600, depending on how you do the math. And so it's a pretty large company, meaning you have to do a lot of cold emailing and outreach and making friends and kind of getting people to do introductions. So that's one reason. The other is, boy, isn't it so much more fun to write about rockets and electric cars than payment services, right? And so you have this issue. It's a real issue, by the way, in the lives of the people who live this story. They have today resources and renown that I think far outpaced what they maybe ever imagined possible when they first started tinkering with computers, right? Meaning they never thought computer code would lead to this, or maybe they did, but it was in some far off, like, kind of part of their lives. The problem with that is what they do today is so interesting, controversial, fascinating, path-breaking that they are the subject of attention for what they do in 2022. It's frankly, I got a little bit of grief for going back and asking them, like, what were you doing in 2002, right? And so it's not the first question if you have access to an Elon Musk to say, hey, take me back to that payment thing you did, right? Like, I don't care about SNL.
Right. Forget about your Twitter SEC.
That's all well and good, but how about those payments, right? That's like, take me back there. But I actually found that part of what had happened is that the passage of 20 years also allows for a degree of honesty they couldn't have had in the moment. So I read all the reporting that was done at the time. I read about a lot of the stories, and there's a lot of new material in the book because people were finally past the experience and were happy to open up about it.
Well, it's a really compelling book. I got to say, when I first heard about, a book about payments and the history of PayPal, it's not something that necessarily you think is going to jump off the page, but it's a really compelling read. So, Jimmy Soni, thank you so much for being with us to talk about your book.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for giving, the Midwest another underline with this, because I do think of this as a big part of the story, and I'm happy to share it with your listeners.
The book is The Founders, the story of PayPal and the entrepreneurs who shaped Silicon Valley. The author again, Jimmy Soni. And that's all the time we have for our program today. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield and Jose Zepeda. The Responsible AI Conversation was originally produced by Erica Scalise. Our interns are Owen Henderson, Anaya Jones, and Zainab Qureshi. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening, and happy Hanukkah. May your candles burn brightly this season. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.